Welcome to the High Tech High MOOC podcast brought to you by the High Tech High Graduate School of Education. Find more at www.hthmoocs.org. That's www.hthmoocs.org. You're listening to School Talks, part of the New School Creation MOOC. Details can be found at newschoolcreation.appspot.com. Unit 6, Presentations of Learning.
We are live. It is the Apollo 13 crew of the New School Creation MOOC. Tonight is our last night. Welcome aboard, everybody who's flying with us. We have Laura McBain here tonight. Thank you, Laura, from High Tech High's Graduate School of Education. My partner in crime, Rob Reardon, of these many years, is with us as well. And Patrick, our technically proficient master of ceremonies here. So we have several questions to talk about tonight. And as always, we don't go for an hour. We go for as long as we find there are interesting questions to answer. So hopefully we'll find some for you. Here's the first one. And that is something that we've frequently been asked. And Laura, by the way, I'm going to ask to give an international perspective to this because she's traveling a fair bit. But in general, of all the questions, here's a question they say you've already been asked in the past, but what would you have done differently? Mm. What are the mistakes you made that you could learn from? And Rob, do you want to say something about that?
Sure, Larry. I would rephrase the question a little bit, and which would be, what were some of the choices that you made in the beginning in the design and early implementation of the school that kind of foreclosed on other choices? Mm-hmm. One choice, for example, that we made at the outset at High Tech High was to group students by age. So we had grade 9, grade 10, grade 11, grade 12. Well, we had just 9 and 10 to start with. What that foreclosed on was cross-age grouping. So we did have cross-grade grouping in advisory groups, and we had it in certain intersession kinds of intervals, but in our day-to-day work in classrooms, we were not cross-age groups. I had come to High Tech High having taught in a school for 15 years where it was not age-graded, so I was used to teaching students who were spanned the grade levels, the high school grade levels, all in one classroom together. So we made that choice, and we foreclosed on another. Traveling in cohorts allowed us to keep diverse, integrated classrooms, and that was our real priority at that time. I'll say two other things about choices we made in the beginning that we rectified. One was that we put teachers in a teacher's workroom altogether away from the traffic pattern of the school. And so kids found it hard to find them sometimes, and the teachers were not present where the traffic was, so there wasn't an adult presence there and so forth. So by the second year, we had moved teachers in offices right into the main traffic lines and right next to their classrooms so that they were kind of scattered throughout the physical environment, which made it a much better kind of situation, not isolating the teachers away.
And one that I remember, Rob, is we had begun with 9th and 10th graders when we first opened the school. So for those of you out there who are going to begin with a high school, people often say, why don't you want to begin with 11th and 12th graders too? And our response to that was that, you know, people are going to look at what happened with the 12th graders after the first year, and we didn't want to be in the position of saying, well, we only had them for a year. So you're kind of doing debt service on your property. You kind of want to be full, but you really can't do that. So we had 9th and 10th graders for that reason. And Rob and I had seen something in another city in the United States when we worked on the new urban high school project, and we thought at first that we would have kids doing projects in the great room for part of the day and academics for another part of the day. And that led to us randomly taking all of the students and splitting them into the blue team and the yellow team. Blue and yellow are our colors for some reason. And to this day, those students think that the blue kids were the smart kids and the yellow kids weren't, and that is not the case. So you've got to be very careful about arbitrary gestures like that. Another quick one is advisory groups. So what I like about having an advisory group, mine's grades 9 through 12, is that ninth graders are watching 11th graders go through the most measured year in a human being's life. They're watching 12th graders, and I'm saying this in February, watching 12th graders be really anxious. They don't know where they're going to be going to college, where they're going to be living. And if it weren't for being in an advisory group, where else would 9th and 10th graders experience that? So this idea of how you group kids is very important. Laura, did you want to say anything about what you've seen anywhere in this regard?
Yeah, I do. Thanks. So most of my work is around looking at, obviously, external school sites that are not only just beginning or transitioning their school settings. And I think, I've heard a lot of different stories with around to what's working, what's not working. Rescheduling the schedule. The schedule won't let me do it because I can't work with the kids because the schedule is this way and things like that. But I think one lesson that I think is really important is the power of language. I worked with a school that decided they were going to do a small school within a small school startup, which I imagine some folks maybe in the class might be thinking about that particular model. And they decided to have one wing as the PBL wing, and then the other wing of the school is kind of the traditional wing. And what that set up was actually a dichotomy between what 21st century learning is supposed to look like and quote-unquote traditional learning. And it set up this kind of, I'd say, antagonism between project-based learning versus traditional teaching. And I think this idea that it really created kind of some animosity between the teachers because some folks were getting the supports while others were not. And it was a simple challenge of them changing the narrative to teachers about actually what we're really trying to do is really just good teaching. And so I think as schools start developing kind of their narrative as their beginning is, what are you actually after with respect to kind of creating the school culture around this concept of what teaching and learning looks like? Because I think what we often use simple terms to describe very complex structures in pedagogy and forgetting about the implications. So one of the things that I think about this particular school is that they got rid of the idea that we're doing PBL in this classroom and this teacher's not doing PBL. Actually, all we're really doing is everyone is focusing on best practices and how do we highlight all of those in this school. And I think that's it's a very subtle thing with respect to kind of changing and creating a school, but I think it's probably really, really powerful about how we actually invite teachers into the process of creating the kind of school-wide pedagogy that they believe in. So I think it's very important to think about how you're describing the pedagogy in your school and what is the implications for that on other people who may or may not understand what it is and who want to be involved in it. So that's just one minor example. And then I think the other thing, I just got back from a school in Spain, and they were working with us for the last couple of years, and one of the things I quite noticed about them is this idea that they've done some projects. They've done quite a bit. And I think the thing that I was most profound by was their ability to get student work up right away. They knew that they really had to create an environment in their school where student work was present. And I think that's one of the narratives that I see new schools is they have to wait a bit. We have to kind of wait till we get projects, and we have to wait until the work is good enough for people to see it. And I think back to High Tech High, I think if we had waited until the work was good enough for everyone to see it, we might still be here waiting to put work up. And so this narrative of we have to get work up because that is where the conversation begins in schools.
And we also don't want, situations which we're accustomed to seeing in the earlier years, which are our teachers who feel that we'll do projects when the kids are ready to do them. But first I have to teach them some things before they...
Yeah.
So on that note, Rob, this question has come in. What are the major unifying themes in project-based learning?
Oh, very interesting question. Well, one is that the work needs to be authentic. So authenticity. What are some problems in the community that we can explore and perhaps remediate? what are some questions that are that kids are asking in their own lives, that are asked in the community, and that are asked in academia? In other words, essential questions. So the notion of having, of pursuing an essential question that has kind of an authentic cast to it is really important. The idea of inquiry is really important. My view is that no inquiry, no project. I mean, you really don't have a project, properly speaking, if there is not kind of some kind of investigation and involved in it and understanding that grows out of it. And then there's the notion of product or performance. What are the ways in which one will demonstrate the findings of this work? And that might be a play. It might be a comic book. It might be a video. Lots of different ways that that can happen. But there needs to be some tangible product that by which students demonstrate their learning, and then finally an exhibition of that project to an authentic audience. I think of project-based work as being related to problem-based learning. It's the notion that a classroom or a set of classrooms is a think tank, and we're trying to identify problems and work at them and devise solutions and share those with the world. I think one of the pitfalls in project design in traditional settings, and I've worked in the traditional setting for many years, is that we often think we need to start with the subject matter and figure out something interesting to do that will meet our content area requirements. We prefer to go at it the other way, to find interesting problems, authentic work, engage in that work and that investigation, and then check back into the subject matter area and cross-work back to whatever curriculum content standards we are beholden to.
That's very good. I have a follow-on from one of our own teachers, actually, Rob. In your opinion, what is the most important thing for a new teacher to focus on, learn, and develop?
Oh, okay. That's a fabulous question. I love it. When we hire new teachers, we bring candidates in, and we ask them to observe in classrooms and tell us what we're seeing, to teach a demonstration lesson of something that they are interested in, and we let them know what's going on in that classroom. If they want to try to connect to what's going on, they can do that, or they can do a one-off lesson. They interview with students. They interview with potential colleagues, and we put them in small groups at the end of the day to read together a short, provocative text and to discuss it and to understand it more deeply while sharing the air, and we witness those conversations. What I am looking for on those days when I'm a participant, I'm looking for someone who wants to know what and how students think. So I think the most important thing for a new teacher to remember is to not lose sight of and to continually rekindle one's curiosity about the minds and thinking of the students that we're working with, and to develop the habit of consulting with students, of eliciting questions, of honoring questions, of helping students to understand that schooling and learning is about asking good questions, not about having all the answers. It's about asking good questions. So those are some of the things that I think are really important for new teachers to do. What we try to do in our credentialing program and in our graduate school of education with experienced educators is to hone the reflex of consulting with your students. If you have an issue or you have a question, take it to the students and get their input. We so often miscalculate and underestimate the thinking that our students are capable of. Sometimes it's because we're so focused on what we want to convey to them that we forget that there's a lot of really interesting activity going on in the minds in front of us.
Very good. And, okay, I've got another one that I think you might appreciate. Also from one of our own teachers. It seems that there's a strong tension between teacher as designer, which is one of our design principles, and teacher autonomy, and developing a shared mission and vision as a school. Does this limit the development of a philosophy shared by teachers, having the notion of teacher as designer? Do they conflict?
Yeah, well, I think there's a potential conflict, and I think people may invoke one principle against another. I mean, we've got four design principles here at High Tech High, and one is personalization, and one is common intellectual mission. And so someone might say, and this happened early on in the school, a group of teachers came in, a couple of teachers came in to the staff meeting, you remember this, Larry, and said, let's group the kids by their prior math course. And someone else in the group and the faculty then said, but wait a minute, that's you'll track the students, and all the courses will be that way. That's tracking. And the group said, the small group of teachers said, no, look, here's the list of the students. You can see that each group is a very diverse group. And Larry, you said, well, if let's look at these groups and look at their cumulative, their average, grade point average in each group. And if we have grade point average of 2.2, 3.0, and 3.7, we've got a problem. If it's all around 3.0 or whatever, no problem. Then, of course, we looked, and it was 2.2, 2.9, and 3.6. And the teacher who brought that in was most vigorously arguing for these new groupings, slammed this fist on the desk and said, then we can't do it. And we have finally made a decision based on data. So the point is, you've got design principles, and they bump up against each other. But that's the joy of it. That is the occasion for dialogue about purpose and about where we're heading. So we have teacher as designer and teacher autonomy, and we have the desire to have shared purpose, which is the key element of a new school and developing school. To generate a sense of shared purpose. I don't see the conflict, frankly. If you have articulated already a shared vision about what significant learning looks like and what a place might look like where significant learning is going on all the time. In our case, we brought in, you and I, Larry, brought in three terms that were very important. Personalization, we want to know students well. That came from Ted Sizer and Debbie Meyer and the Coalition of Essential Schools. Common intellectual mission, we want high expectations for all students. And for us, that meant we're not going to track students. And we're going to try to develop a common language across the disciplines for all students. And then adult world connection. Those were through internships and other means to connect students to the world beyond school. Those were our bedrock principles. So teacher autonomy and teacher design operates in that context, and we're all accountable to those principles. So a teacher brings in a design and says, here's the way I want to do it. It's legitimate to have the conversation amongst colleagues about, okay, how does this work advance our personalization agenda, our common intellectual mission agenda, and our real world connection agenda? Those are the principles that we're accountable to. So teacher as designer and teacher autonomy unfold in the context of those design principles, which represent our shared purpose to which we are all accountable. So with autonomy comes accountability.
Last week, after this MOOC class was over, I had some guests here from Seattle, and we stepped into the nearby conference room. And it was at that point later in the evening, and there were a very diverse group of kids, male and female as well, working on the robotics team. And the guests started to ask them, basically, how's it going, and how do your parents feel about all this? And one young man said, he's a sophomore in high school. He's been here since the sixth grade. He said, well, my parents have been really worried about this place ever since it started, you know. So every year they come in, he said, it's really, but they see my presentations of learning, they see my student-led conferences, And so far, every year, I've been able to get them over the hump, which I really kind of appreciate about his being able to stay here. What about this question of another faculty member? Can you envision High Tech High with non-graded courses? Mm. Do you feel that grades provide an incentive for students to perform?
I think we're already going in that direction. You know, with respect to a middle school and elementary school, the question of whether you need grades, this is the balance we're trying to strike, particularly in the high schools, you know, of accountability and understanding that we have a broader audience to serve. But I imagine in the middle school and the elementary schools, you know, we're after good work. And so the question of what is quality work, I think we have more flexibility in the younger grades than we do in the high school grades, particularly because of colleges and looking for grading. I don't see why not. I know that two of our middle schools are really rethinking this idea of, do we need grade levels? I'm much more interested myself. I do remember the first time we did a presentation of learning, and one of my students ran down the hallway, and he was so excited. He came up to me and he said, I got a 98 on my POL. And I was like, oh, no, I don't want to know that. That's not what I'm looking for. I want to know what you did well and where you want to go. I don't necessarily care that you got a 98. That's great for you, but that's not what I want to know. And so I think this question of balance, of knowing that we have multiple people to serve, I don't see why not we could go in that direction. It's a question of how do we make it necessarily, you know, thoughtful, so that kids are getting really thoughtful feedback about their work. And I think we already have some systems in place to go in that direction. And I would see a lot more kind of comment-based grading that would go in that direction to kind of get at that. Within the high schools, I wonder about that. I think with respect to the badge movement that's actually happening across the country and MIT looking at portfolios, there was just a Huffington Post article, I think, this weekend about the value of the SAT or devaluing the SAT for college applications. And so, you know, I wonder how that, particularly how other schools and big Ivy Leagues are now not using grades as a determinant for entry. In that vein, I feel like there's some exciting movement within the upper grade levels to kind of move away from grades too.
Can I jump in here? What I was going to say was that over the past 5 years working here, I've experimented with just about every kind of assessment that you can probably think of. But I remember that I think the basic question you have to address when talking about grades is what are their functions within the multiple levels of community that you're dealing with? What purpose do they serve? What gods do they bow to? And I think the tricky thing as a high school teacher is that there's so many different things that they need. I think that there isn't a complete abandonment. In my opinion, I don't think there's a complete abandonment of grades because I think that we built a structure around language. But I do think that you can create new language. And I think when people can align their values in the beginning of understanding a community, at the very beginning, I saw this in Ted Cuevas's and Kay Flewelling's class when I first came in to teach, where they had used all of their assessment in the habits of heart and mind. They all talked about assessment in regards to the habits of heart and mind. And the kids never talked about grades. They never talked about, did I get an A? Did I get a 73 on this? They were talking about, how did I refine my work? How did I do this? And it was in that transference. But there has to be an understood then piggyback to that of like, well, if I'm going to use this new language to talk about my assessment, how does that translate when I go to tell my parents how I'm doing in school? How does that go to translate into telling colleges what my GPA was, whether that's important or not? And I think that we don't have enough teachers who are educated on all of those different levels that they don't feel confident in designing and pushing the envelope on that. But I am seeing it happen, like, all over the place here.
Yeah. What about this question of I think a lot of people who've been writing in have asked this question about the pressures that you're under from parents, from colleges, about, you know, this isn't what schools are supposed to look like. And how do you address that when you are a new school that's really trying to, above all, attract people, because you're not going to exist if you don't succeed in attracting people. And while people are considering that, I wanted to say a word to give you a moment to think. Because when we began, I remember a lot of families saying, and we're really wondering about whether this is really okay for our kids, but we know that we can't leave. And I said, well, we're not asking you to leave. How come? And they said, our kids love coming so much. It was very curious that it was not that they thought it was wrong that their kids loved coming so much, but the kids really did start to enjoy coming to the school. And then for us, in terms of assessment at the high school level, which is somewhat different than the lower grades, we've had very substantial four-year college completion rates. So that settled families down into feeling, well, my kid loves going, the colleges really smile upon them, so, you know, basically, what am I really worried about? And that has afforded us an opportunity to not do a lot of things that schools typically do, like we don't have driver's ed, for example, or we don't have bells, you know, or we don't have a mascot. What about this question, again, about that it's not just what you put in, it's what you don't allow in? I want to go back to that. And Rob, you've spoken about that a little bit. What are some of the things that you've seen, like separation of math and science? What are some of the things you've seen sort of that keep sort of, it's like a leaky ship where the water keeps finding its way in of going back to traditional activities, and how do you react, how do we react to it?
Well, I think you brought up the math-science issue. I mean, math and physics are a fairly easy combination. For us, that would be in the ninth grade. Math and chemistry is a tougher combination, and it might be better to look for combinations like chemistry and art or math and history and so on. And that's the kind of thing that we've been experimenting, that our faculties have been experimenting with, kind of looking for new combinations, but there is this one of the huge issues for us and for schools in general, I think, has to do with subject matter loyalties. The fact that our teachers are trained in a particular subject matter, that their professional identity is tied up into that subject matter, that the professional development organizations and mechanisms around the country are subject matter based, and so on. And what we're trying to do is to integrate the curriculum to achieve a coherent day for students so that they feel that they are working on one thing or two things rather than taking five or six homework assignments home every night. So we're trying to create a more coherent day and integrated curriculum and teacher subject matter loyalties and the whole structure of curricular mechanisms and textbooks and everything, the way that they are, you know, as initially dictated by the Carnegie Commission back in the 1920s, exert a very kind of a powerful influence on the way that we think about school structure and what's normal in schools. So that's one thing that you know, it's if you're asking what we keep coming back to, the default that keeps rearing its head, that's certainly one thing. And then the second thing I think that rears its head is the notion of teacher isolation, and that teachers close the door and do their work, and as long as it's quiet, nobody's going to complain. The notion that the basic point here is that we are asking students, we're asking our teachers to foster and develop and model 21st century skills with their students, and they by and large are working in a 19th century work environment. So there's a default that just goes back to that. I've got my subject matter. I teach with this group of kids, then I'm ready for the next group of kids, and so on. And so what we're struggling against that all the time. I think we're doing pretty well with that particular one in terms of teacher collaboration and providing an environment where teachers can and do collaborate and model skills of collaboration for their students.
Okay, very good. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Because I think this is a great question, because we, you know, in my work I talk to a lot of schools and they're thinking about what they, in a lot of conversations people come, I want to do an internship program, I want to do projects, and it becomes a very long list of things they want to do. And so in working with schools that I've, you know, worked with over the past couple of years, I rather ask the question is, what are the things you never want to see in your school? When you go into your school, what do you never want to see? And they might say, I don't want to see blank walls. I don't want to see a teacher in front of the classroom. I don't want to see kids sitting in rows. Those often, I think, in having conversations, dictate the philosophy more than designing the design principles, which I think is a bit more challenging, actually, because they need to be thoughtful and they need to be thought out. And really, so I think this exercise in designing your school, if you were creating a new school, is when you walk in the door, what do you never want to see happening? And from there, actually, dictates your philosophy pretty thoughtfully, I think.
The thing that I would least want to see would be social class and other types of segregation of students.
Exactly.
Smart classes and dumb classes. And for what it's worth, we figured out a way to do that with the University of California in our case, where, for example, Rob and Laura could be taking an honors class, which you need to get into selective colleges, whether we like that or not, to get a weighted average, and Larry is not taking the extra honors option, but we're in the same room with the same teacher at the same time, which makes me feel motivated to feel like, well, actually, Rob and Laura are really smart. I think I could do that myself, and then a lot of kids move to that.
And it's never pointed out, right? Like, it's never pointed out that you're not able to be in that class, or that it's like, oh, Larry's going to sit in the corner because he's not able to understand AP content. I also think, like, one of the things that's really important here is that we do that thing that Larry was just talking about. We don't single kids out, and we... I'm sorry, I lost track, but there was something that Laura said that I thought was really, really, really important. Organizing around that thing. So the first thing that you said on that list that a teacher would say would be like artwork on the walls. And I remember I worked really closely with the administration of the school I was at last year, and it's impossible for any school to do everything. And I think that that's a really important thing to remember as you're designing your school, because if you want to do everything, it means that you're going to do a lot of the things you find really important a lot less well than you would like to do them. Like, there are sacrifices that need to be made on certain fronts, and there's some that you can't make, and you need to identify what those are immediately as you start.
Okay, we have a question sent in by a couple from Tony McCurdy-Hemming, and thank you, Tony, for doing that. How would you go about supporting teachers to feel more comfortable taking risks in their teaching?
That's a great question.
Can I jump in on that?
Yes, please.
I think there needs to be time for teachers to talk with each other. I think one of the things that we did right at the beginning of High Tech High was to build a schedule where teachers come to school an hour a day before the kids arrive. Then, of course, we had the issue of how do we use that time, but we secured the time. So then the issue of how do you support teachers to take risks, you set up, and we've used protocols a lot for this, ways to have safe conversations where teachers can share their work and make themselves vulnerable to each other in the service of improving our work and better meeting the needs of our students. So that what happens when teachers begin to share their work that way is that teachers share risks that they're taking or things that they think they might want to try, but they're not sure how it's going to turn out, and they receive support from their peers to go ahead and give it a try. And in fact, you know, we're fond of saying also that we can all learn, that our students can learn from failure in project-based learning and so forth. Our teachers can also learn from magnificent attempts to do things with their students that don't quite pan out. And yet there's still a learning for the teacher and for students in that. So, but it's all about this is all about relationships generating a culture where teachers are listen to each other and support each other, and where it is safe to take risks, then also bleeds down into the student culture as well.
I've got something on that too, sorry.
Go ahead, Laura.
So I think it's something about the leadership of modeling and being very transparent that when they're leading their staff, they might say, we're trying something new, I don't know how it's going to go, and be very reflective when they're leading their own staff about actually taking risks and actually modeling that to their staff. I think it actually sends a loud message that they're trying as well, and that actually encourages teachers to take more risks, and actually modeling that as leaders I think is really important, so that teachers see that we're all in this together. I think that's really important. And then I think a second piece that I think really goes back to Rob, this past week, Azul and I were helping these teachers they had never done project-based learning very much, and we put them through this whole experience for the week, and they did an exhibition at the very end of the week, exhausted and tired. We wanted to go to the very first thing people want to talk about is what didn't go well, right? That's the go-to. And we started that conversation, and we said, what can we celebrate? What worked well this week? Because we can make a list of all the things that didn't go well, but we need to start with what can we celebrate, because by celebrating, it encourages people to take more risks. And then I think the last thing is this idea of assuming good intent. You might have a teacher that might be going out and reading with their kids in the park, and as opposed to asking, why are the kids not in class, talk to me about this experience. This idea that people are making decisions of a professional decision, and they've thought about it. So this idea of assuming good intent and coming from that perspective is a very thoughtful way of going about it, and I think it eventually, as Rob said, it gets to this culture of risk-taking, but you have to come from that perspective, I think.
And I'd like to add to that, and also add to my answer to that, a question from Jonathan Fantasia. And Jonathan, you asked several financial questions and noted that maybe this is not the night for it, and it isn't. So we're going to pass on that. But you asked a good question related to what Laura and Rob are talking about. How do you assure that project-based learning is available to the teacher as well as to the students? And I think this ponies on to the question about making teachers feel more comfortable taking risks. When you have in projects observation and reflection and documentation, a lot of folks who do it don't do that next step, which is public exhibition. If I am a new teacher and I'm in a new setting where there's a lot of other people that are doing work that where they are taking risks and they are doing they are really doing very interesting work with their students, and I'm nervous because I'm new. And Rob, everyone, the parents are coming in, and uncles and aunts and cousins, and everyone's looking at the students that are in Rob's class, and everyone's looking at the students in Laura's class, and everyone's looking at the students in Patrick's class, but they're not really looking at my students' work that much, you know. Well, I'm human, and I really notice that, and I start to think to myself, what is it that Rob's doing? What is it that Laura's doing? What is it that Patrick's doing? What can I do differently the next time? How can I learn from these peers who've been doing this longer than I have? So I think that the role of the public exhibition should never be underestimated in terms of as an accelerant of making these types of things basically happen in schools.
Yeah,
I agree with that completely. I remember my first exhibition, and I thought my partner teacher, we had created human-powered vehicles, we had documentaries, we had done all this work, and then I walked into the hallway of High Tech High, and there was a bunker built, a replica of World War II, and the students were speaking French and talking about their experiences, and I looked at myself, I said, what have I done this year? I haven't done anything. I haven't done any great projects this year. And so this idea of, like, inspiration is crucial for that.
I think also, I love that, I mean, exhibition is really key to all of this. I think also prototyping. What we've learned to do over the years is to insist with teachers that they do the project themselves, that they build a prototype of the project that they're going to ask students to do, so that they can be aware of the snags that their students might encounter as they do the project. So that's another piece for us in terms of supporting teachers in making this transition into project-based learning.
Terrific. And now, on the downhill side of this last particular session of this course, I've got three questions for us to wind down with, and I think they're pretty good ones. And the first is from Dan Levy. Thank you, Dan. What do you think the first day of a brand new high school should be like and or feel like? Everyone from school director to teacher to student to parent, etc., are all new, experiencing this together.
Well, I think that in the first day, people have to have an experience of the workings of the school, of the way the school intends to work. So if it's a school that where we're emphasizing students' peer learning and students learning from each other and talking with each other and so forth, a lot of that has to happen the first day. If we're interested in creating a sense of community and learning who we are as a community, that has to happen on the first day. But the biggest thing, I think, is it's a new school, and we're creating it together. We're pioneers in this. So what do we want it to look like? It seems to me that that's a wonderful opportunity to have kind of at least part of the day be a design day and a wild ideas day. In your wildest dreams, what would the perfect school look like? So that we can capture some of those ideas and begin to work together towards them. So I think a vision, a getting to know you exercise, beginning to form relationships, and a visioning exercise to say what do we want this place to be that we're going to construct together.
Can I add on to that? Because he says the first day, and I think I would expand that to the first week at least, if not
the first Yeah, week. The first year maybe.
Yeah, because I think...
But maybe the first 10.
Yeah, I think the thing is like we want to... I think there's this, particularly in high schools, we want to rush to content. We have to rush to content. We have to make sure the kids are getting... And I think we do a disservice of culture when we don't spend time getting to know the kids, doing the exercises that Rob described and talking to that. That's more important. I would rather see 2 weeks of really culture building and exercises like that than any type of content-driven, really heavy. You can do culture building via content, and that can happen. But I think it's about these ongoing events. And I also think, too, that one thing that I remember when we started High Tech Middle is that you think we had to start the culture right away, but we also revisited the culture throughout every school week in advisory. Every week we were doing something about culture building, and we didn't stop, and we still don't stop doing that about culture building. It doesn't, the culture building doesn't stop after the first 2 weeks. You have to constantly go back to it, and you have to go back to it in your classrooms. Even when you're starting a project, you have to go back to it. It's an ongoing cycle.
Okay, and now this is one for all of us. What do we think is the future of schools like ours, as well as universities and colleges, in terms of the role of online courses? I just something that sort of a metacognition question that's being asked of us because we're doing our first online class. There's another one that High Tech High is doing with the MIT Media Lab. This one's with Cal Berkeley. That one's on deeper learning. This one's on new school creation. Just sort of a reflection. What have we learned from this? Where are we going with this? What do we think are the pluses and minuses of this type of experience? Anybody?
When I first started High Tech, I remember Ted Cuevas and I were talking about like High Tech High, and he was saying that High Tech High isn't an answer for everybody. It's just an answer. And he was talking about this idea that we really wish there was a lot more answers. And what's exciting about what we're doing here with this MOOC is 5 years ago this couldn't happen. We're in a period of time where learning can now be connected to passion and not just by zip code. There was we had to learn based on where we were for so long. And a lot of these new technologies are making communication and passionate learning happening across the board. That's what I'm most excited about, is there's education mastery that can happen within education for the first time, I think, in a long time.
I know Rob and I, when we talk to visitors and things like that, we talk about this community of practice. And I think what's so great about this online community, really, and I've been working closely with the Deeper Learning MOOC, is that we've got 3,000 or close to 4,000 people in this course, and now this community is actually a pretty strong community. They're showing work samples, they're showing their products, and I think not only are we able to disseminate some of the work, but the work is coming back to us. Is that it's not just high-tech high sharing, it's people creating and sharing back and learning together. So I think these online communities via the MOOCs are really creating a real community where people are actually defining and refining their work within their context. And I hope to have them grow. I mean, people are having separate meetups online from their courses and talking about their work, which, again, as Patrick said, couldn't have happened. And if we can be a lever that encourages groups to get together online or in person and share their work, then I feel like that's a great movement, I think.
Yeah, I think the potential for connection is really enormous. I'm going to be in Boston next week I'll be there for other reasons, but I'm going to join the Boston meetup of the deeper learning community there. So I'm going to meet a lot of new people that I would not have met by any other means than through this course. So I think that's very exciting. I've all along been kind of skeptical about online learning, but I'm changing my tune a little bit. I think a blend of I'm really looking forward to meeting these folks in Boston. I find that online stuff is in some sense easier or more meaningful if I've met people. So I'm still in this kind of middle space of thinking about hybrid kinds of things and blended learning and so on. But I'm really, really converting over.
I was going to say something similar to that, to what Rob said. For me, and for those of you who are on this MOOC right now, I'm accustomed to being in the same room with people and having the nuances and the winks, the nods, the different ways that you know that you're with people, and why I think that Rob feels as I would, that a meetup is really kind of human, and there's something about just talking out into the cosmos like this without seeing you that's a bit of a challenge. I think that the promise is more for me. I'll give you an example of the promise. There are a set of 15 courses in this state of California that you must take to even be considered for getting into the University of California, and about a third of the high school seniors in California take those courses. And the people who are not taking those courses are in rural California, which is somewhat impoverished, and inner city California, which is somewhat impoverished. And they're going to high schools that don't even offer those courses. And I think that there's an equal protection argument and a real equity issue about the delivery, and it is a different pedagogy that we might not prefer, the delivery of those courses to people who don't even have a chance of taking them. I would like to think through mobile devices and the like. I'd hope to see something like that, because it would be somewhat more equitable in my view. So now our final question for tonight, which we get asked very often. I'm going to ask it of everybody here. It's a personal reflection on us, since these people are asking us questions like, what would we do differently and this and that. Where do you see High Tech High in 5 years? In your magic ball, right? Well, I'll go first, since everybody's hesitating. I will say this. Unless, I think in general, for any institution, there will be a regression to the mean of normalcy unless you pay constant attention to all of the different issues that we're talking about tonight. I think that is a tendency that happens. And I also want to take advantage at this moment of agreeing with Ted Cuevas's point What the world does not need necessarily is more high-tech highs. What the world needs is more differentiated schools and more experimentation in schooling.
I can say that I hope that high-tech high doesn't change much about itself in the next 5 years. I've really loved high-tech high. I came here from the different part of the country, and I didn't know that I could love math. As I thought I was an art teacher who was just supposed to teach art. And when after leaving here, I'm now programming courses, and I'm doing all this stuff. And I learned as much as I was learning right next to the students the entire time. And this place is very much a mecca for me for inspiration. And I really hope that the school just keeps doing what it does, because this is a beautiful place.
Okay. Anyone else, Laura?
I see a lot of, there's a lot of promise, I feel like, right now. We've been doing a lot of projects on Kickstarter and doing some really cool innovative projects with laser cutters and one of our math physics classes down the hall, and looking at online learning, blended learning, and I'm wondering about, like, how we encourage innovation with our students, more student-centered projects. Thinking to, I can't remember the name of the student who created the mobile fish, you know, that moved around.
Oh, yes,
yeah. Right. And I'm just interested in innovators and how we can, even as ourselves, kind of get beyond these projects that are content or kind of standards driven, if you will, because we still have that to meet. But how do we create projects, as Rob likes to say, where students can surprise us? I'm looking for more and more surprises, I will tell you now. That's what I'm hoping for when I see us in 5 years, is I want to see more surprises from students of projects we didn't think about. That's what I'd like to see.
Okay, very good.
I'm in that general ballpark. I would hope that we'll see a lot more design, a lot more student participation in the design of projects. And I would hope that we would see really deep embeddedness in projects that serve community needs and even broader needs. I was looking, I read an article in the Boston Globe the other day, a column, about some teens in Boston who, in 1998 or so, in the inner city in Boston, seeing what smoking had done in their families, the cancer and other diseases and so forth, in their families, and seeing the way that smoking advertisements were targeted towards that community, they decided to do something about it, and they started demonstrating outside of pharmacies and places that were selling cigarettes and so forth, and they just kept at it. And, you know, 20 years later, 15 years later, CVS Pharmacy has declared that they're not going to be selling cigarettes anymore. So there's this kind of thing of things that kids were working at 15 years ago have borne fruit. Right next to that column in the Globe was an article about a 9-year-old kid who had been killed by gunfire. His older brother was playing with a gun, and the kid was shot and killed. And so a long, long article about that. So I'm thinking teens taking action about something that, at that time, people thought, oh, no, nobody will ever get anywhere against the cigarette industry and so forth. And now, gun violence, and we've got a project going on in Chula Vista with kids campaigning against or trying to explore what can we do about gun violence. I would like to see more of that kind of activity where teens are taking on issues that mean something to them. And certainly gun violence means something to our kids in their neighborhoods at our schools in Chula Vista. But taking on issues that are big issues and really kind of working at them. I would like to see more of that.
Terrific. We have many people from around the world who have been asking, and we're going to make this a mechanical MOOC, which means that basically we're going to edit these Google Hangouts, and that with all the other material that we've created and the material that some of you created will be part of a MOOC that other people will be watching in the future. And again, those conversations and questions from people around the world that we always find endlessly interesting. So I want to thank my dear colleague and friend, Rob Reardon, for being with us this evening. And Laura McBain, international traveler, is a rare moment when she's actually just a few feet away from us here, so we had to grab her tonight. And Patrick, thank you so much for really helping to be the midwife on this thing. It would not be possible to have done this without you. And finally, to everybody out there who's thinking about creating a school, remember, it's far too easy for schools to become unnecessarily complicated. Keep it simple. Go forth and multiply. Thank you all. Good night.
All music with permission by Spike and Reggie Music Licensing and Publishing. For more, visit www.spikeandreggie.com.